On this edition of Thinking Biblically, Avner Bosky is back with another Israel update. Welcome to Thinking Biblically. My name is Alan Gilman. Thinking Biblically is a podcast dedicated to exploring how all of Scripture speaks to all of life. Well, I'm really excited to have Avner Bosky back on Thinking Biblically, first time in several months. Avner has provided Israel updates for us ever since shortly after October the 7th, 2023. But before I introduce him again, I want to remind everyone, if you haven't done so already, to please subscribe to this channel. Also, please like and share as appropriate. Let's get the word out to as many people as possible. Also, thank you to those who support my teaching ministry. And if you would like to do that, you can get more information about that at my website, alangilman.ca/support. That link and other links referred to in the podcast will be available in the description. And so let's go to my interview with Avner, which I recorded on Wednesday, January the 29th, 2025, in the morning. Well, I'm so happy to have Avner Bosky back again to give us what I call an Israel update. He was here around October 7th to do a 1 year after. This might be his fourth time since October 7th, 2023 that he's been here. He's been so helpful, not only in these podcast times together, but through his newsletters. Avner does such a good job in analyzing from a biblical point of view the situation in Israel and in the region. And we'll give you information about how you can get a hold of those newsletters a little bit later on. So Avner is a Messianic Jewish teacher, writer, and musician who provides an insightful, biblically-based view of God's heart for Israel and the Middle East. I first met him in the late 70s in Montreal, Canada, where we are both from. Sometime later, Avner and his wife Rachel immigrated to Israel and eventually settled in Beersheba. Avner has written several books, including Jews, Arabs, and the Middle East, A Messianic Perspective, which is a great book to help you understand the complex dynamics of the current conflict. You can learn more about their ministry at davidstent.org. Avner and Rachel have 4 sons, 3 daughters-in-law, and 6 grandchildren. It's so good to see you, Avner, but normally you're in Israel, but you are in another promised land, are you not?
Yes, there's Jewish grass, which of course I used when I was a teenager, but this is bluegrass, which is Kentucky. I'm visiting my son who's taking his doctorate at Asbury Seminary in New Testament and Greek.
Well, it's wonderful that you can do that. As time allows and the Lord leads, we'll talk about this interesting country. Apparently, there's forces that want to turn us, Canada, into the 51st state. Some people think it's a joke. Others don't think it's such of a joke. I don't know if we'll get onto that one, but we will talk about the country of America eventually, most likely. A lot's happened even since we last talked. In October, there was the surprising outcome of the war with Lebanon and the fall of the Syrian regime, and more recently, the beginnings of the hostage so-called deal and the presidential inauguration. But before we get into some of that, if we do, I wanted to point out your recent series of articles on the history of the Islamic Caliphate and how that relates to the current goings on. I find that so much of the trouble with us understanding the Middle East situation, it's those of us in the West, is that we're dealing with a worldview that's so foreign to us. I just came up with this last night. What do you think? It's like playing checkers on a Monopoly board.
Do you collect $200 and pass go?
That's not my point. Do I have to explain the illustration?
But this is what I want you to do for your people.
We're supposed to get an extra $200 GST tax credit in the mail. I don't know when it's coming or something like that. But that's not what you're talking about.
No.
Folks, if you've seen me, if you've seen some of my early pre-October 7, 2023 talks with Avner, you know that I have trouble controlling myself when I'm with him. But we're talking about some very serious things.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So my point, do I have to explain my what I thought was a genius illustration, playing checkers on a Monopoly board?
It is. Good. It is good.
Because... Well, I don't have to explain it to you. I want you to explain it to us, because so much of the problem is, and I've been dealing with this in other areas as well, the conflict of categories of thought and much trouble we have. And imagine we could, even in marital squabbles people who are even close to each other, often we have difficulties because we're not even talking about the same things. And on a global scale, the Islamic view, much of the Middle Eastern view of life, how we relate to people, everything from honor to honesty to what I call the long game. I don't know if that's just a thing on my mind. I think you've mentioned it in your newsletters. There's much of the world plans with centuries in mind. In much of the Western world, we plan, especially with political things, with the electoral cycle, right? So 4 or 5 years is about how our leaders, they look down the road, they make their plans accordingly. They're not thinking of making policy today that will either take 100 years before it really comes to fruition or making any of those kinds of plans. They'll even make plans to spend money. This kind of a little bit off topic, but it's the point. So we'll get politicians, I know it happens in Canada, I don't know so much in the States, they'll have these 10-year spending plans, knowing they will likely not even be in power 5 years down the road. And so they'll give an impression that they're doing this wonderful plan, but they're not going to even be paying for it later on. And so they've got this short-term mentality, and I think that's affected us. And of course, our individualistic society in the West, very self-centered and very short-sighted, unlike the part of the world you're living in, have been living in for a long time. So.
Well, this reminds me, of course, of Stalin, who had his 5-year plans. And of course, the difference there was he remained after those 5 years, but nobody else was alive. But that's a Russian joke.
But I'm sure he had more than 5 years in mind.
Yes, he did. He thought he was never going to die, you know. A lot of people live that way, by the way. So they never get to the point of considering ultimate issues, but that's another issue. One of the things Yeshua said years ago, he said, thy will be done. He didn't speak it in Protestant English. He probably said, "Ta'aseh ritzoncha ken b'shamayim chen ba'aretz," thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And there's a secret there that most people in the West have difficulty with. They think of the fulfillment of God's plans being only in heaven, in a kind of a Greek Platonic idealistic sense. But the concept of his will being done on earth, whether it works or not, we're going to die, we'll go to heaven, that's where reality kicks in. So there's a sense of denying the reality of things on earth. Well, along come the Jewish people who are on earth. And God says, I've chosen you, I have plans for you. It involves, if you're obedient, I'm going to do these wonderful things. If you're disobedient, I'm going to scatter you to Ottawa. But then I'm going to bring you back. And this not only offends much of the world, but it's hard to get their arms around this concept of God working in space and time. And a lot of it is because of the influence of Greek thought. So in the West, you have to add to that.
By the way, I completely agree with you. I'm looking forward to seeing where we're going with this, but I think it is very key.
Hang on to your hats, and we are going, or to your toque if you're from France or Quebec, and les toques, hein, la toque. And if you look at now your question, now I forgot what I was saying. I have to get back to what I was saying. the issue of
on earth as it is in heaven.
Yes, indeed.
Greek thought.
And so when Jewish God people. Basically calls the Jewish people to exist on this planet, for much of the church, the view of the Jewish people has been so highly colored by replacement theology that they say God is finished with the Jews. They're never returning to their land. We look forward to being in heaven. And so the very existence of the Jewish people is a thorn in the side of many believers. And when you talk about what is God doing with the Jewish people here today, there's a lot of blowback, a lot of saying it can't be, it's not a spiritual thing, it's not something God is going to be doing. So tell me your question one more time so that I can make sure I'm answering it as opposed to my question.
Well, it's all about the different worldviews, the fact that we in the West...
Yes, look I got at the, it. I got it. And so in the biblical world, in the biblical worldview, the concept of God choosing a nation, giving them a land, those things today are, of course, very politically incorrect. It's all right for Europeans to come to Canada and to claim the land and then to feel bad about it, but do nothing really about it. But for Jews to come back to their land according to prophecy, that's a real bad problem. That's primitive. That's getting in the way. That's, you know, who knows. How would Joshua rate in terms of his calling today by most believers and most secular people? But in the Middle East, you have a situation where your people, your land, and your religion, they're all together. Now, if you go back 400 years in Canada, that kind of was the perspective. You had the Protestants in Upper Canada, the Catholics in Lower Canada. If you go back 700 years, you have the Catholics in France and the Protestants in, let's say, Netherlands. But what's happening today is that people think that the Middle East has undergone two things that have happened in the West, and that's the Enlightenment and the Reformation. And our society is built on, here in the West, on both of those things. So in terms of Enlightenment, that it's not who turns over the table and yells louder who wins the argument, which is the Middle Eastern way. It's, reasoning and thoughtfulness, making a winning argument. As far as the Reformation, there was an understanding that ultimately, from the Protestant perspective, the scriptures are the basis of our faith, whereas in the Islamic world, they never had the sense of, to be a little bit more accurate, they never had the sense of one can analyze the Quran and do higher criticism on it. There was no such thing. And so people basically view the Quran and whatever it says, even if there's huge inconsistencies going on, as what Muslims need to believe. Now, in the West, the Muslims, for the most part, until recently, who've come to the West, have suppressed their Islamic intentions and beliefs in order to fit into a kind of a Unitarian Canada, let's say. And so they talk about unity and nice living and proper ethics and stuff. But what you see happening in the past, let's say, 5 years in Canada, especially since October 7th, is the real face of classic Islam coming out, which is, I don't know if you remember Hook, the movie Hook, but there's a line in Hook, he says, "You shouldn't be against me, I'm a lawyer," and they say, "Kill the lawyer." So when you get to what some people in the Middle East say, they actually have a theological perspective that the Jewish people are cursed, that they're evil, that they're deceptive, and the end of days solution according to the Islamic hadith, or the oral law, if you could call it like the oral tradition, is that the Jews are needing to be destroyed. Now, if you come into a Western country where everyone is polite and non-committal, how do they deal with this perspective? How do they deal with the perspective that in classic Islam, the world is divided into two, those who believe and those who don't? And if you don't believe, then you need to be crushed and forced to convert to Islam. And if that doesn't work, then you need to be a second-class citizen if you're a Jew or a Christian. But if you're not a believing Christian and you don't submit, then you're to be killed. So that perspective is considered totally outré, not acceptable. And so to try to understand the Middle East without understanding where people are coming from is really putting on something, a mask. It's like, you know, going to Venice for the masked balls. No one really knows what's going on. And this is kind of what's happening as far as how the West is responding to Israel and the Middle East today. Even Bible believers, okay, are so influenced by this pagan and secular viewpoint that when they're confronted with Jewish biblical teaching, they reject it. And they say, oh, that's primitive. That's old time. We don't want the old time religion. We want the PC religion.
Okay, so you've been addressing a couple things kind of all at once. You've got...
Because I have so little time.
Because the reaction of the West to the current crisis has itself is complicated, because on one hand, you know, we are the inheritors of the Enlightenment, the Reformation, like you were saying, but on the other hand, throughout North America, Westerners have been joining these so-called pro-Palestinian protests. And it's not that we saw this with things like Black Lives Matter, where people are taking to the street and they're being violent and they're calling for destruction and they're calling for a revolutionary type of approach. So these people are not any longer sons and daughters of the Enlightenment and those principles. They're actually falling in the name of what they call progressive. They're falling into the ways and means of a far more ancient time, where the, as you're saying, the person who shouts the loudest and shows the, you know, the acts out most violently are the people being heard and they're getting attention. And so we are facing that here. But I would guess a lot of the people from a European type background don't really understand for a minute what they're doing and what they're allying with.
Yeah, it's a combination of blend of like three things. That would be one of them. The second one would be socialist revolution, because many people in the West who were not conquered physically by Russia were conquered politically by those perspectives. And even in Canada, growing up, I remember the things I prayed for, not a believer, not believing in God, but as it were, prayed for when I was 16, how Canada would be transformed, have happened. And it's not good. And then the Lord got hold of me. And then I realized that some of the things that I was hoping and living for were actually going to bring destruction to the West, which is, I think, where we're going to.
And if I understand it correctly, like the communistic socialistic worldview is actually... one might say that it's pre-Enlightenment. It goes back to group rights over individual rights. You don't have the importance of the individual that became so important to the modern world.
Yes and no, because if you think about it, the concept of individual rights that we understand today is based on the Bible but departs from the Bible. Because in the scriptures, the concept of the people existing, they're all submitted to the biblical law, but individual rights don't go so far as saying, I can choose whether the biblical laws are good or bad. Everyone was required to obey that. So there's an element where group Weltanschauung, you know, of perspective was important. And I mean, you could be put to death for things. You know, sometimes we say, look at Saudi Arabia. They put people to death for things. How primitive.
Yeah.
But then in the Torah, it says people can be put to death for things. So that comes back to the concept of...
But that's because of the importance that God put on the individual. That, in, as you said, to Noah, you know, by if you spill man's blood, your blood will be spilled. You know, every individual is made in the image of God. And as an illustration of the importance of each human life, going to the question that I was asking at the beginning, is we could talk about the hostage, I call it hostage so-called deal, and listening to some Israeli reflection over what's happened is, on one hand, the desire to bring back each individual hostage, like each one of them, it's a Jewish proverb about he who saves one person saves the whole world. So there's a value in Jewish life, which I believe is derived from scripture. It is godly that each and every individual is a precious creation of God, as opposed to the group mentality and the ideological mentality that they're up against. So you end up with a so-called deal where Israel is willing to do just about anything to bring even corpses back, and being willing to continue to put themselves in such a dangerous situation by releasing thousands of murderers on the Palestinian side. So can you speak into that?
Sure. Let me just finish that one thought for half a second. The Bible does say that if you disagree with God, you're wrong. Mm. And so the issue of individual decisions only goes so far in the Bible. It goes so far as salvation. And so I was just referring to the fact that sometimes we give group mentality a bad deal, but yet we actually do believe that in certain other areas. But to get back to your question of the hostages, there was a famous Chinese general named Sun Tzu. And he wrote a book called The Art of War. And he said, find out what hurts your enemy most and hit him there. So the strategy that specifically Yahya Sinwar, the former head of Hamas, figured out, having been in Israeli jail for having killed four Israelis and a bunch of other people too, very cruelly, was that Israelis care a huge amount about casualties, personal casualties, battlefield casualties, terrorist casualties. And he said, that's where we need to go after them. And so his whole idea and strategy was kill as many as you can, capture as many as you can, and make Israel crazy and then start fighting with each other about these issues. That's his strategy. Has he succeeded? Absolutely. Do most Israelis, are they aware that they're being manipulated by this strategy? No. What do? They get angry at the government. But it wasn't the government that took these people hostage. And so we have then a whole political element where people are trying to, the opposition is trying to get people angry at the government in order to bring down the government. It will not solve the hostage issue one way or the other. So as far as what they've done is when they murdered and raped and killed babies and young women and pensioners and other Israelis, over 1,200 people, they took also 250 people prisoner to kind of dank tunnels underground, didn't feed them, tortured them, raped them, etc. They didn't have any desire to keep those people alive except as a bargaining tool. If it would cause Israelis more anguish to kill some of these people or whatever, that's fine. That's very much what they're looking for. So there's an old story of a scorpion and a frog trying to cross a Middle Eastern river. And the scorpion says to the frog, please give me a lift across the river. And the frog says, no way. You're going to sting me. We're going to both die. because you can't swim and I can. And the scorpion says, why would I do that, my friend? And so they argue back and forth for half an hour, and finally the frog says, okay, I'll take you. They start swimming across the river. Halfway through, the scorpion stings the frog. They both start drowning. The frog says to the scorpion, my friend, Habibi, why did you do this? And the scorpion says, Habibi, this is the Middle East. So the issue of being willing for Hamas to have casualties on their side to the last Gazan civilian, or for the Jews who are prisoners to die, this is par for the course. This is the way jihad worked 1,400 years ago. This is the original stuff that went on with the originally mujahideen, the jihad warriors. So it's nothing new if you know Islamic history and if you know Middle Eastern history. But it's a shock to people in the West who assume, you know, that everybody grew up watching Batman and Robin television series. It's not the same way in the Middle East, not at all. So what's been going on is Hamas has been willing literally for Gaza to be destroyed. Why has Israel been going in? Because they're wanting to get the hostages out and stop Hamas from firing rockets into Israeli civilian areas. If Hamas had not been doing those things, there would be no invasion. There would be no destruction. Israel's bending over backwards not to cause civilian casualties, in the words of Colonel Kemp of NATO, who said there's no country in the world which cares about lowering civilian casualties than Israel. And yet the UN and the ICC Criminal Court are accusing Israel of genocide. So the UN, which was set up as a result of genocide against the Jews, is now accusing the Jews of genocide. It's poetic justice here. And that's where we are as far as these things. So the whole nation is in a place of agony and division. And we're ending up biting each other. It says in Galatians, be careful, if you bite each other, you may end up devouring each other. And this is kind of what's happening a little bit in Israel. And it's encouraged by those countries in the world, including Canada, America, New Zealand, Australia, the Five Eyes. It's encouraged by them because they want the land divided and a Palestinian/terrorist state set up on the West Bank and Gaza. That's their goal. They stated very, very clearly.
And well, in so their minds, do they want a terrorist state there, or they have some sort of idealistic view or political view of why? I'm assuming they don't see any other solution.
No, that's not exactly true. The CIA trained some of the top terrorists fighting against the Russians. One of them was a guy named Bin Laden. They trained Hanan Ashrawi, who was one of the main Palestinian spokesmen. They trained the Red Prince, who was involved in the Munich attacks. Their view, when you get into the world of intelligence, they have different moral standards. They say that the end justifies the means. And they believe, why should a little small group of Jewish people control a small area when the rest of their neighbors don't want it? And so they're saying, we want oil and we want influence, and the Jews are getting in the way. So that's
well, is it? Okay, so there's oil and influence. We could talk about why do they want to influence, except is it all about the oil?
Superpowers always behave in their own interests. That's the way it's always been.
But what's the benefit?
Control.
But control for its own sake?
Sure.
A notch in the belt?
Why did Napoleon try to conquer the world? Why did Hitler try to destroy Russia?
Well, do you think, so if Israel for some reason annexes the West Bank, takes some sort of control of Gaza.
From whom? Who would they annex the West Bank from, by the way? It doesn't belong to anybody. It's never been declared as belonging to anybody.
Right. Okay. If Israel asserts sovereignty over the West Bank, is that better language?
Sure.
Okay. If they assert, what's that?
It's more accurate.
Okay, yeah. If Israel asserts sovereignty over the West Bank and somehow has some, for now, possible military control of Gaza, what's in it for the West to push against that?
Because what do they gain? The West's interests are to have good relationships with the Middle East, a secure supply of oil, blocking Russia and China.
Okay, so Trump starts talking about, and we're going to get into him maybe, sending some of these poor Gazans to other countries because it would be better for them and they would help with the rehabilitation of the Gaza Strip. Already, these countries have been saying no; they don't want them there. So he's thinking in terms of possibly what's best for the people in the region, almost like there's no history. Let's just do what's best. And so practically speaking, it's possible that, and there have been others who have been suggesting this, that the state of Israel has the best tools to care for these people and for those, that land region. And that would be what's actually best for the region all told.
That's Western thinking. We're not in the West.
This is my original question.
Right. So, for instance, when 70 Palestinian terrorists with blood on their hands were released to just north of Ramallah, they had huge demonstrations in their support with people chanting, kill the Jews, and waving flags of Hamas group and their terror faction.
You're talking just this past couple of weeks, right?
Yesterday. Okay. If there were elections taken right now in the West Bank, by all the surveys, it shows that Hamas would come in overwhelmingly. So when we talk, and the same thing is true in Gaza, demonstrations everywhere. So there's a kind of a false narrative that the people who did those terrible things, the Nukba terrorists on October 7th, they don't represent the Palestinians. They do. Mm-hmm. And this is something that until people understand that the whole people stands with Hamas. Now, when you do have a dictatorship, which will kill you if you disagree, that does bring extra motivation. But even when it's freedom, they choose Hamas. Remember back in 2006, 2005, they chose Hamas to be in charge of Gaza. They support Hamas. And Hamas basically says, we will not stop until Israel is totally destroyed and all Jews are murdered.
Yeah, I think, can you explain for a moment? I've read your newsletters. I hope there's lots of people here that haven't yet read your newsletters, but will. Hamas, I think in some people's minds, Hamas is like this naughty group of people causing trouble, rather than an expression of a very large, powerful ideological aspect of the Muslim world today. Can you explain that?
Sure.
So who is Hamas really?
I grew up with my mother spying for the Soviet Union in Canada. We were raised to believe in my own house that communism is going to bring good to the world. I remember one time a little later in life when I said to my parents, do you know that Stalin was responsible for killing 50 million people? They threw me out of the house. So a lot of people in the West today, as I said, don't understand schmatz about what's going on in the Middle East. They don't understand the teaching of the Quran or the Hadith. And they think that Muslims basically are just peace-loving people who believe in the unity of God and eating halva. But that's really much deeper than that. There is a demonic influence across the Middle East based on the false revelations that some spiritual being named Jibril or Gabriel in Arabic, supposedly under another name, living in another country under another name, came and spoke to Muhammad and said, basically, you have to conquer the world for this belief, which includes that Yeshua, Jesus, is not the Son of God, that he didn't die on the cross, that God has rejected the Jewish people, and that the Bible that the Christians and Jews have is totally distorted, that there is no Trinity. These are essential beliefs in Islam. And according to the teaching, if you don't agree with those, you are to be made a slave or murdered. And people say, oh, no, that's old. It's not old. It's very, very present in the Middle East today. Hamas is part and says in their charter in the first line that they're a member of the Muslim Brotherhood Group. And the Muslim Brotherhood Group is to bring about the caliphate, which is total Muslim control over the entire world, a Muslim dictatorship, where, again, if you don't bow your knee, you're either put to death or enslaved. That's their goal.
And how real and practical is this? I think a lot of people think of some of these things as just like this niggly nuisance that causes some trouble here and there. How serious is this? Like, how many people are part of the Muslim Brotherhood? How much is going on in the world where they're exerting influence? Why should we care?
Well, let's take two countries which are the main supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood today. One is called Qatar or Qatar, and one is called Turkey. Qatar and Turkey have just been the main bankrollers and strategicians for HTS, which just took over the country of Syria. Qatar supported the Muslim Brotherhood Morsi, who took over Egypt. Turkey is supporting all kinds of attacks against Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, etc. The Muslim Brotherhood tried to take out Jordan. The Muslim Brotherhood subgroup, Hamas, took over Gaza, threw the PLO off roofs and shot them in their knees, like in Northern Ireland. They're very influential. And in the West, people are asleep and they don't understand what they're facing. Just like years ago, when communist revolution was going to take over the West, many in the West were asleep. Now, some people who were against communist revolution had no sense of humor and were kind of square. And so they kind of get laughed at 30, 50 years later, but they saw there was a danger. Islam nearly conquered Europe. They nearly conquered France and Vienna twice. They took over nearly everything in North Africa. Even today, when you call all those people Arabs, the Arab world is basically not Arab. There are about 170 nations who have been forcibly converted to Islam and forced to speak Arabic and believe in Islam. So we don't talk about them anymore. For instance, St. Augustine, one of the fathers of the church, okay? He was from North Africa. He was a Berber. Today, Berbers are considered Arabs. They're all followers of Muslim. But that was the center of Christianity in North Africa, in Hippo, in those days. So things change.
Now, you're talking ancient history. I think we need a little bit more for people to actually believe you that there is a threat today. Because don't Europeans go to Turkey as a vacation destination? So there's trouble, always trouble, you know, in the Middle East itself. But why should we care? Why is it a danger to us today?
Just read the newspapers about what's going on in Canada. Are there not huge anti-Semitic demonstrations in Toronto and Ottawa and in Montreal and in Vancouver and all over America? Are there not people who are saying Israel, the leaders need to be arrested and jailed, that Israel's guilty of genocide, that it should be thrown out of the family of nations?
Oh, this, so you think we should believe what they're saying and take it seriously?
Very much.
Yes.
This is what happened in the 30s in Germany. We're seeing a repeat, and people are denying it now, even as they denied it in that time. But I'll tell you one thing. Jewish people in Canada are waking up. They're not woke. They're awakening. And they're saying, I think maybe our future is not in Canada. American Jews, European Jews are saying all the same thing.
So I want to talk about the supposed different approach we're getting from the new U.S. administration in a second. But first, I want to go back to the hostage so-called deal. So we're dealing with people that want the destruction of not only the Jewish people, but Western civilization as we know it. And their threat should be taken seriously. So then Israel enters into a deal, which lawyer Alan Dershowitz actually says it's not a deal, it's extortion, whereby, yes, we're getting these people back. Whether we're going to get them all back or not is yet to be seen because of how this so-called deal is being worked out, little, you know, releasing people little by little, the agony of waiting for the names and not knowing if they're alive. And then when the time comes, and do they release them all? It's horrible. Why did Israel agree to this kind of so-called deal? And I didn't mention, again, the release of actual murderers who are some of them serving multiple life sentences in Israeli prisons. They're being released freely to likely do, again, what they've done in the past. Why go for this?
When Hitler rose, going back in the 30s and early 40s, America didn't want to fight him. And Britain sent over a man named William Stevenson to the Rockefeller Center. And there was a sub-agent named Ian Fleming, later known through James Bond stories, to try to encourage Americans to realize the danger coming from Hitler. So in the same way as the West was kind of asleep, I think we're dealing with something very, very similar. It's not a deal when you have extortion. So America realized in World War II that in terms of fighting Germany and fighting Japan, they couldn't do it just by slogging through without tremendous loss of life. So they did things including the firebombing of Dresden and Leipzig. And the Americans dropped, also those were British bombers mostly, and they then dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that ended the war pretty quickly. The only way you're going to deal with kamikaze people, whether they speak Japanese or Arabic, is by taking the same strategy. But we have a situation here where America has a divided heart, and because of America, also Canada and Britain and all the Five Eyes countries, where they're supporting the main supporters of jihad in the world today. So Qatar and Turkey are the main supporters of Hamas and HTS. Some of you know HTS is the jihadi group, Bin Laden associated Al-Qaeda group, which took over Syria. America supports these countries, has its biggest air bases there. CENTCOM, Central Command, is there in Qatar. And so you have a situation here where they don't want Israel to win, the Americans. They want Israel to have a limited success and then stand down. But for us to stand down means the order of the rising sun called Hamas is still there. That means the Nazi party is still there for us. And unless we, like in, again, the movie Hook, where Hook says to Peter, unless you fight me, I'm coming back to kill your kids in every generation. And that's what we're dealing with right now. And so we've had huge pressure on us to step back from being decisive. If Israel wanted to do genocide in Gaza, it would take us 3 days. Gaza would be no more.
Now,
Trying to do that.
Okay, so under Biden, the U.S. would put on various, you know, the pressure like every other time this has ever happened. But this, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first time that Israel has pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, we're not going to pull out. We're not going to stop. We're going to see this to the end. And then
partially that's true. And partially Israel has submitted to American diktats about slowing things down, not doing things, feeding our enemies, giving them oil.
Sure. But we've never seen so much pressure put on Hamas and as much pushback as this time.
So right? Let's call it 50% yes, 50% okay. Holding back.
Okay, but then Netanyahu agrees to this deal.
Why do you think?
Well, I know there's. I want you to tell us.
So one of Reagan, one of Trump's main friends, his golf partner, is a Jewish man named Witkoff. And he was sent over.
I think it's, isn't it Witkot? Is it Witkoff or
Witkoff.
Witkoff?
Yeah, what do I know? Maybe it's Witkot.
I'll double check when people
are. It's with an F. It's double F.
When they're not looking.
Yeah. So he was sent over. And he came and he said, I'm showing up on Shabbat to talk to you, Bibi. And the Israeli government said, listen, we don't meet on Shabbat. This is our day of rest. It's a religious issue. All coalition parties are bound to keep that. And he basically said, I don't give an F about Shabbat. You're going to talk to me. Otherwise, Trump is going to turn against you. So that's mafia pressure. Okay. And if one studies Israeli history, there's been this type of mafia pressure since the 40s. It's nothing new. Although the Jewish community will say it's not so bad, that's kind of the response of an abuse victim talking. So there's an excellent book for your listeners, and it's called The Secret War Against the Jews. It's written by John Loftus, U.S. at the end. He is an American too. And Mark Ahrens, who is from Australia. And it deals with how the Western Intelligence, State Department, and oil for the past 80 years at least, maybe 90, have been having a policy of weakening Israel, hopefully destroying them, and if not, at least shrinking them to be irrelevant. Kissinger said the same thing. I quote these in my newsletters. You can read them. So we're talking about a narrative which is in the news, which is not really what's going on behind the scenes. And that is Israel is being pressured. Just today, the articles say that Witkoff is going over to Saudi Arabia to arrange a situation where there will be peace and ceasefire and release of hostages and a PLO state in territory that God has given the Jewish people. That's where we are. That's the very non-hidden goal behind this. And that's why Israel was prevented from decisively dealing with their enemies, not for the first time. If you had 2 hours, I could give you a blow-by-blow since 1948 of the same dynamic exactly.
Whoops. Okay, sorry. A bit of a problem with pressing the buttons here. So it is a Witkoff, as you're right. I should have accepted that. Because
I could be wrong, too.
Oh, that's so humble of you, Avner.
Well, it's also true.
Oh.
It's never a virtue to speak the truth about yourself. So humility isn't a virtue, it's a statement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So big business and self-interest is the main driver.
For all human history.
And so we shouldn't be surprised that that's what's at work here. So is Trump ultimately different? Could we expect something different with him in the White House? Or one way or another, it's always going to come down to the same thing.
Well, if you look at the prophetic scriptures, ultimately it says all the nations except Canada are going to come against Jerusalem. So I assume it means all the nations except America as well. So no.
Not Canada, right?
Ultimately, that's going to happen. Now, Trump has done things that no other president has done, which are pro-Israel, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital, recognizing the Golan, and many other things. And recently also many other good things that unfortunately the previous president of the United States, whose name I forget, didn't do. But at the same time, Trump is actively pushing for a two-state solution. And these people are not working off the scriptures, because the scripture basically says you try to divide the land of Israel, you're under the curse of God. Now, again, if the Bible doesn't mean what it says, or if we're not to interpret it literally, then, hey, anything is possible. But if we are going to take the Bible as having some authority, it's a dangerous position to take. Trump's family, unfortunately, has received a heaven of a lot of money from Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and they are very, very much in their pockets in those areas. So you have a president who is doing two things at once. We have an expression in Yiddish, "Mekenesh tansonis tzvechasenis b'tein tuches." It's very hard to dance at two weddings with one behind. And so America has a divided heart, a divided pocketbook, and a divided strategy. And this is, it's in Canada, it's even worse, actually, because the PC view has totally changed Canada's view toward the Jewish people and the Jewish state.
You're referring to the politically correct. You're using PC for politically correct?
PC, not progressive conservatives.
Which they're not but called that anymore. They're the Conservative Party of Canada.
What are they called now?
Now it's the Conservative Party of Canada.
What color do they use?
Blue.
Blue. I remember in Quebec, Duplessis used to say years ago, red, that's hell. Those are the people, the liberals. Blue, that's the Union Nationale. Those are the ones who are going to heaven.
These are provincial parties for those of you who aren't Canadian.
Back in the 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. Yeah. Long before there was television.
So is there a conflict of values in somebody like Donald Trump, though? Is that one of the things that we're seeing? So that he too is beholden to big industry, big oil, big bucks.
I would say it's really hard for anyone to know. I think oil and intelligence and state have been in that direction since the 20s and 30s. And I haven't seen any change going on there. Charles Colson, who became a believer, talked about how Nixon and he were able to pass laws which got buried in the Beltline because those who make the decisions of how it's going to be worked out have vested interests. So even in what's called democracies, there's not a direct correlation between laws which are passed and laws which are fully enacted. And so I think it's something worth praying about. And if your listeners want to pray for Canada and America on these issues, it's so important to pray that God would take away a divided heart and give a biblical heart. No question that Trump is speaking really warm things to evangelicals and Israelis. He just invited the Prime Minister of Israel for the first diplomatic visit to Washington on February 4th. But having said that, he's also having Witkoff going to Saudi Arabia today to work out how to get more money from Saudi Arabia. Everything in the Middle East comes with a price.
Okay. Well, this is, as usual, very helpful. And I do want to encourage people to sign up for your newsletters. So in terms of contact to you, I think the best way is to go to your website, right?
DavidStins.org. Just say, yeah. I want the newsletter.
Right. In fact, I did a little bit of research, and almost every page of Avner's website, davidstent.org, if you go to the bottom of the page, there's a little form where you could sign up for his newsletter right there.
We don't hit people up for money, and we only write when we have something to say.
Yeah. And Avner has a lot of good things to say. And so I encourage you to do that. Any parting words this time around, Avner?
Well, what is it? You asked about Canada becoming the 51st state. When I grew up, we were saying that had already happened, but this was the circles that I moved in. I think America has enough problems dealing with 50 states of its own. And I think the problems in Canada would not be solved by making them all Americans. I think it's spiritual problems in both countries. Trump loves the art of the deal, and he loves to bluster, and he loves to start by saying something that shakes everybody, and then he starts negotiating. So he's probably responding to the son of Pierre Elliott and some of the son of Pierre Elliott's agendas, which he doesn't like, and he's probably responding to wanting the country of Canada to be less socialist and less and more pro-American. He's a bully. That's his kind of way of doing things. It's not my way. I don't like that aspect. But having said that, this is an opening gambit in the art of the deal.
Yep. And we will see. Well, thank you again so much for coming on. And hopefully we'll have another time soon with another Israel update from you.
It's great. I think actually Canada could get away from this very easily by just saying, listen, we'll give you all the maple syrup from Quebec in exchange for leaving us alone.
Well, why you probably know some people in high places, Avner. Why don't you get that? And you're close by. You're in Kentucky right now. You can pay him a visit yourself. Well, thank you, Avner, for coming on Thinking Biblically, and I look forward to the next time.
Great to be with you, Alan.
Well, again, in order to contact Avner, you could do so at his website, davidstent.org. That's davidstent.org. If you have any questions for me, you can email me at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. That email and information about Avner's website will be in the description, just like any other links that mention on this podcast. If you would like to support Thinking Biblically, you could do so by going to alangilman.ca/support. That link will be in the description too, just as I said. So it would be great to hear from you sometime. Don't forget to share this podcast. It's also available on audio. If you are interested, you could access that on your favorite podcast provider. If for some reason Thinking Biblically is not available there, please let me know and I could make that arrangement. And so until next time, this is Alan Gilman with Thinking Biblically.